and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 18th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to the front page of today's Cedar Rapids Gazette. Breweries tap into big changes as alcohol laws ease, by Elijah Decius of the Gazette in Cedar Rapids. If brewer Todd Vile wanted to sell a six-pack of Witch Slap beer at Clockhouse on September 1st, he couldn't just hand it over to the customer and take payment at his downtown Cedar Rapids location. It was a little more complicated than that. After canning the beer on site, Clockhouse staff had to package their beer and load it onto a truck to their beer distributor, who would process it through a warehouse, load it back onto a truck, ship it back to Clockhouse's taproom, and put it back on their shelves. That's because Clockhouse Brewing, like a lot of popular breweries adjacent to restaurants in the corridor, operated under a brew pub license that prohibited self-distribution directly to customers. Though electronic transfers of beer inventory were made legal in 2020, some distributors didn't enable them, and switching beer distributors can be a difficult task. With one of the biggest overhauls of Iowa's alcohol laws in decades, breweries and restaurants are praising SF 2374, signed by Governor Kim Reynolds in June, for modernizing state code to match the needs of a growing industry dealing with significant challenges after the pandemic. It's a large bill that became a discussion for all things alcohol modernization for Iowa this year, said Noreen Otto, executive director of the Iowa Brewers Guild. We really want to elevate Iowa beer as a product and a destination. This legislation absolutely does that. The new law, which took effect September 2nd, makes changes that will affect every brewery and restaurant in the state. Native brewers, such as Lion Bridge Brewing Company, now will have the option to sell spirits in their taprooms. Brew pubs like Big Grove and Clockhouse can sell their beer for home consumption directly to customers without going through a beer distributor. Breweries can creatively experiment with stronger brews because the law raises the alcohol by volume cap from 15% to 19%. Bars, restaurants, and bars can purchase up to 5 cases of beer or canned cocktails per day at retail locations as a stopgap between beer distributor deliveries. Restaurants and bars no longer need to apply for separate Sunday sale licenses. The number of available licenses was consolidated from 14 to 8, and licensing fees were reduced. Though native breweries and brew pubs will benefit most from the changes, small breweries will feel a stronger buzz from the new implementations. For Vile's Clockhouse, which pushes about 1,000 barrels each year, the changes are welcomed after 18 months of shrinking profit margins, rising costs, and inflation. The hard part is we can't just keep raising our prices. Nobody's going to pay $10 for a glass of beer, he said. This helps us tremendously. The cost savings for Clockhouse from labor alone and the legal shuffling required to sell to-go containers from its taproom will save thousands, Vile said. Can sales are roughly one-third of their sales. The downtown Cedar Rapids Brewery also will be able to sell beer kegs for carryout, allowing for a greater variety of keg flavors compared to what they can offer through retailers like Hy-Vee. The bill is extremely helpful for our industry, a modernization of the law itself, said Dave Moore, director of operations for Big Grove in Coralville and vice president of the Iowa Brewers Guild. It's something we can build off of, and it'll be good for the health of the industry. Jessica Dunker, president and CEO of the Iowa Restaurant Association, said the law changes are huge for restaurants and bars, too. Until now, restaurants and bars could only buy beer through distributors. Those that ran out of beer could not get more until their next distributor delivery. The new law will allow them to buy up to 5 cases per day from local retailers, an important stopgap highlighted by pandemic supply chain disruptions. The Iowa Restaurant Association fought hard for the privilege, Dunker said. It means beer stands at a stadium in the middle of a football game, or concession stands on a golf course in the middle of a fundraiser, can make a run to the nearest convenience store if demand is higher than expected. For rural establishments, it's an important change that can be used any time. When beer distributors cut certain weekly routes during the pandemic to every other week, many bars and restaurants were tasked with figuring out how much to purchase for 2 weeks and where to store it. At a time when we need to have barriers removed for us to be able to claw our way back, this was a huge barrier removed for us so we don't have to stop doing business or say no to customers, Dunker said. Though the association advocated many years for the changes, it wasn't until the pandemic that the need for them became apparent. We always felt like we needed to have it, but COVID exposed that in ways that were more understandable, she said. From just inside the front page, no injuries after brush burn engulfs rural Coggin House, by John McLaughlin of the Gazette in Coggin. No one was injured Saturday after a vacant house near Coggin caught fire during a brush burn, according to the Linn County Sheriff's Office. The owners of the acreage in the 5800 block of Quality Ridge Road had a burn permit for brush and were burning an area north of the vacant house on their land, which is about 1.5 miles west of Coggin. The owners contacted authorities after wind caused the fire to spread to the house. Emergency responders found the structure fully engulfed when they arrived. The house is considered a total loss. 21-year-old prison inmate dies at UIHC in Iowa City. A 21-year-old man serving time in an Iowa prison died Wednesday at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, according to an Iowa Department of Corrections news release. Keote D. Smith was pronounced dead at 6:20 p.m. Wednesday after being admitted earlier in the week for an acute illness related to a chronic medical condition, authorities said. The Johnson County Medical Examiner will perform an autopsy. Since October 2020, Smith had been serving a maximum 10-year sentence for a second-degree robbery conviction in Marshall County. Last year, he filed an application for post-conviction relief. Turning to the Iowa Today and the News Track section, catching up on an earlier story, competency hearing set for CR man facing three sex assault charges by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette. Background: a Cedar Rapids man was convicted last year for repeatedly sexually assaulting an incapacitated 19-year-old woman in 2018 after meeting her in an Iowa City bar and then recording the attack on his cell phone. The woman, during the sentencing of Carlos Allen Hivento, 32, said she had been drinking with friends at home November 18, 2018, and then they went out to the downtown bars drinking more. Hivento found her alone outside and dragged her into a stairwell and filmed the assault. The woman said she didn't remember much, but recalled hitting her head on something sharp. When she woke up, she didn't know where she was, and there was a bright light shining in her eyes, and she realized Hivento was filming her. During her victim impact statement, the woman said she managed to get her clothes on and get out of the hotel where she found herself. Police took her to the hospital, where a rape kit was collected. Doctors found bite injuries on her body and bruises down her back from where she'd been shoved downstairs. A Johnson County jury convicted Hivento in July 2021 of 5 felony counts of third-degree sexual abuse and 2 counts of invasion of privacy, aggravated misdemeanors. He was sentenced to 34 years in prison. The investigation into that woman's assault led to 3 other women telling police Hivento had sexually assaulted them outside downtown Iowa City bars in 2017 and 2018. One of the women said she was incapacitated and that Hivento filmed the sex acts with his cell phone. Another said Hivento gave her a drink and she blacked out, but someone else witnessed the sexual assault. Hivento was charged in those 3 assaults. He also faces 2 drug charges stemming from the first sexual assault investigation when Johnson County jailers found cocaine in his shirt pocket, according to a criminal complaint. What's happened since? Hivento's 3 other sexual abuse trials have been delayed because he changed lawyers, and one of his previous lawyers, Eric Tyndall, asked the court in November 2021 to order a competency evaluation of Hivento. 6th Judicial District Andrew Chapel ordered that evaluation at the Iowa Medical and Classification Center in Coralville. Hivento didn't cooperate with the psychiatrist there on 2 occasions, and the evaluation couldn't be completed. Tyndall then asked to have Hivento evaluated by an independent evaluator. Chief Judge Chad Kepros denied the motion, ruling that Hivento should cooperate with the psychiatrist at the Coralville prison or face a contempt of court charge. He set another competency hearing for December 13, 2021. Tyndall renewed his motion for the independent evaluation of Hivento. In the motion, Tyndall said Hivento appears to have a significant mental health illness, which prohibited him from participating and assisting in his own defense. When Tyndall and another defense lawyer talked to him, Hivento couldn't comprehend the nature of the charges, the proceedings, or control his behavior, he said. Hivento's behavior and actions during his first trial caused the defense lawyers to make repeated requests for a mistrial and to request a competency determination mid-trial, Tyndall said. Hivento's yelling and disruptive behaviors in front of the jury during that trial and his delusions of malice and unshakable belief in conflict are all examples of how he could not assist in his defense, Tyndall added. In the motion, Tyndall also asked to withdraw from the case because Hivento had stated his goal was to become competent to stand trial so he could fire his lawyers. Judge Kevin McKeever granted the motion. Hivento did change attorneys, and the competency hearing was rescheduled several times. The independent evaluation was conducted in August, and the competency hearing will be September 22nd in Johnson County District Court. And looking at the week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, ACLU argues against fetal heartbeat law. The ACLU of Iowa argued this past week that Governor Kim Reynolds' request to lift an injunction on the state's so-called fetal heartbeat law, which would ban abortion after 6 weeks, has no legal precedent. Allowing the law to take effect would deprive Iowans of their rights as established by the Iowa Supreme Court by limiting pre-viability abortions, the group said. After a pair of state and federal Supreme Court rulings opened the door for more restrictive abortion policies, Reynolds is asking a district court to lift its 2019 injunction and let the 6-week abortion ban go into effect. Grassley Franken split on agriculture. Mike Franken, a Democrat running for U.S. Senate in Iowa, challenged Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley's record on agriculture in a new ad this past week, saying Grassley has let family farmers fall behind while large agriculture businesses benefit. Grassley's campaign said the senator has been a leader in agriculture and on Wednesday announced a Farmers for Grassley coalition of farmers that support his re-election. Railroad labor agreement reached. Railroad business leaders and unions reached a tentative deal Thursday to avert a strike after 20 hours of negotiation over employment contracts for railroad workers. The agreement must be ratified by workers to take effect. A union leader in Iowa said he was optimistic about the proposed deal. State Democrats also celebrated the deal as a win for union workers. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican, warned in remarks on the Senate floor that union members may not ratify the deal. If they don't, Grassley said Congress should step in to force both sides to accept the terms, saying a strike would cause massive problems for the country's economy. Democrats launch policy agenda. The Iowa House Democrats released a policy agenda focusing on programs they say have a majority of support among Iowans. The plan includes expanding public assistance to lower costs, increasing funding to public schools, protecting abortion rights, and legalizing marijuana for recreational use. To accomplish most of these agenda items, the party would need to flip 11 seats in the House, as many of the proposals don't have support for majority Republicans in the chamber. Under the heading, they said, since Chuck Grassley took office, Iowa has lost half our farms. Chuck has taken over $1 million from Big Ag, and he's passing laws to help them squeeze out the little guy. Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate Mike Franken on U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley's agriculture policy. And he's the only farmer in this race. Chuck has tirelessly taken on big oil. He's taken on the four big packers. He's fought for fairness for Iowa's farmers. Republican Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Naig on Grassley's agriculture policy. Under the heading Odds and Ends, more Iowans enroll in Marketplace Insurance. The number of Iowans who have chosen health care plans in the federal marketplace has risen in the past decade to 72,000 this year. In 2014, 30,000 Iowans enrolled in plans on the marketplace established under the Affordable Care Act. COVID-19 cases continue to drop. Iowa's COVID-19 cases continue to fall in the week ending Wednesday, down to 4,109 new cases compared to 4,176 in the previous week. The number of people hospitalized with the virus also decreased from 270 to 232. And under the heading Water Cooler, no injunction against Linmar. An Iowa court denied a request from parents to temporarily bar enforcement of a Linmar school district policy that protects transgender and non-binary students while a lawsuit to negate the policy is pending. Iowa senators skirt abortion ban. Iowa's U.S. senators shied away from supporting a proposed nationwide ban on abortions when asked about it Wednesday. Both senators have co-sponsored bills to ban abortions nationally from 20 weeks of pregnancy in the past, but did not answer whether they would support a proposed 15-week abortion ban Senator Lindsey Graham introduced earlier in the week. And turning to the Insight page, we have a guest column from John S. Westerfield, a suicidologist, professor emeritus of counseling psychology at the University of Iowa, and a board certified in counseling psychology. He writes, "Hope through action. To prevent suicide, don't be afraid to reach out and ask the question." September 10th was World Suicide Prevention Day with a theme of creating hope through action. This provides a timely and important opportunity to review information about suicide and how to try and prevent it. Probably the most important new since July 2022 resource to be aware of is the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, which provides 24-hour-a-day trained crisis counselors who can assist with a variety of mental health concerns, including suicide. This phone number, you can call or text, can automatically direct callers to what has been historically referred to as the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. This is a historic and very much needed development, and this simple-to-remember phone number should provide easier access for those in need. Suicide remains a major public health issue. The most recent year for which we have data is 2019. According to the National Center for Health Statistics, there were 47,511 suicides in the United States that year. That is 130 per day, or one person every 11 minutes. Iowa ranks 23rd nationally in suicides with 528 in 2019. Nationwide, there were 534 suicides among those 10 to 14 years of age. In 2009, there were approximately 37,000 suicides. Thus, the issue remains a major concern and a concern that is growing. All kinds of people from all walks of life are capable of suicide. The World Health Organization indicates that one suicide occurs approximately every 40 seconds throughout the world. For multiple reasons, suicide is very difficult to predict. However, there are some warning signs that are important: threatening suicide, suicidal ideation, being depressed, substance abuse, severe chronic pain, access to lethal means, exposure to another suicide, previous suicide attempt, history of violence or victimization, loss, social isolation, feeling hopeless and/or helpless, and how the person answers what suicidologists often call the question. The question is, have you been feeling so badly lately that you have thought about harming yourself? Or words to that effect. Most people will answer the question honestly. However, what is challenging in working with suicidal people is that many people will also answer it ambiguously. What can we do to address the issue of suicide? First, should you be concerned about someone being suicidal, it is important to act. Reach out and do not be afraid to ask the question. Many people will appreciate you opening up the topic and giving them permission to talk about their feelings. It is also important to monitor the person, provide support, and try to get them into treatment. Often treatment will be resisted initially, but don't give up on working to help them find the treatment that they need, because eventually many will enter treatment. Calling the new 988 resource is obviously now a mechanism to get help for yourself or to request help in dealing with someone else whom you may be concerned about. Finally, it is important that communities, schools, and other groups provide education about this issue by presenting suicide prevention workshops. These workshops focus on three issues: warning signs, what to do if you are concerned about someone, and local and national resources. As World Suicide Prevention Day approaches, consider what you and your community can try to do and lower the suicide rate. And remember the newest resource, 988. Althea Cole's column today to A Candid World: Parents Remain Concerned About Lindmar's Policy. I can't say I didn't see it coming when a federal judge denied a request by a group called Parents Defending Education to temporarily enjoin the Lindmar Community School District from enforcing its new policy related to gender identity last Tuesday. The writing was on the wall almost a week prior when Judge C.J. Williams expressed doubt that the plaintiff had successfully demonstrated evidence of actual injury. I also can't say that the judge made the wrong decision in declining to block the policy from taking effect until the lawsuit to nullify it altogether is decided. This might seem like a tremendous departure from my position when I first wrote about Lindmar's new policy, titled Transgender and Students Nonconforming to Gender Role Stereotypes, back in May. It isn't. I continue to assert, as I did 4 months ago, that the policy passed for the benefit of a very small minority of students could easily come at a grave cost for others. The word could presents a hypothetical situation, though, and in order for an issue to have standing in a court of law, the plaintiff must demonstrate injury in fact, that they have or will imminently suffer injury, if the relief for which the petition is not granted. Lindmar's policy was passed a month before the last school year ended, and the injunction deliberated less than 1 month into the new school year, so very little time has even passed during which a student would actually be at risk of suffering harm from the new policy. Courts do not, and absolutely should not, rule on hypotheticals, and no caring and concerned individual is going to hope for a child to experience the kind of harm they feel will happen under the new policy simply for the sake of being able to go to court. So it's a swing and a miss for the plaintiff, that plaintiff being not the parents themselves, but the organization suing on their behalf. But whether a permanent loss or temporary setback, the fear that many Lindmar parents have of their children being harmed by the new policy is not assuaged. That fear stems mostly, if not entirely, from three separate concerns. The first is that their children as young as 12 years of age may end up sharing intimate spaces such as locker rooms or overnight lodging accommodations with students who are biologically of the opposite sex without their prior knowledge or consent, adding extra complexity to the already complicated dynamics of teenage bodily awkwardness. The second concern of parents is that through the establishment of gender supports, their children could be enabled or even encouraged by school staff to make the profoundly consequential decision to transfer to a different gender while they as parents are kept from the process. Text of the policy indicates the discretion to include or exclude the parent lies solely with the child and contains no language requiring the child to specify the reason for excluding them. Granting the ability to a child as young as 12 to keep their parents in the dark about something so incredibly significant could result in catastrophic injury to the parent-child relationship. Worse, it would happen at a stage in the child's life when they are already naturally inclined to rebel, and in an era when smartphones and social media expose them to an infinite universe of influence that their parents could not have fathomed during their own upbringings. So much of that influence, including that which is gender identity themed, is based not on science but ideology and can easily become unhealthy. It could also prove incredibly dangerous to a child's long-term physical and mental health if acted upon while a parent is kept out of the loop. The third concern among parents is that their children could be subject to severe disciplinary action if they have conflicts with using pronouns which do not match the biological sex of the person they are describing. For some, that could be as simple as a logical struggle to state something different from what the eye sees. For others, the reluctance could be based on conscience, such as religious beliefs related to gender identity. Regardless of reason, failure to use preferred pronouns could snowball into serious consequences when board policy describes misgendering, either intentional or accidental, as a form of bullying and harassment, and violation of the district's anti-bullying and harassment policy is treated with discipline, which may include suspension and expulsion. Pronouns aren't slurs, yet alleged misuse of them has apparently been escalated to the severity of unwelcome sexual advances. At Linmar, such a scenario remains hypothetical. Elsewhere, it isn't. As I wrote in May, the Title IX coordinator for a school district in Kiel, Wisconsin, filed a formal complaint of sexual harassment against three middle school boys this past spring. The allegation contained a single word, mispronouncing. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, WILL, got involved in the case against the three boys, was eventually dropped by the district, but not before the district attempted to complete the whole Title IX process, which can remain on an accused student's transcript and could jeopardize future academic plans. Notably, the Title IX complaint against the three boys in Wisconsin was completed not by the student against whom the boys were alleged to have committed mispronouncing, but by the school's Title IX coordinator. A lawyer with the WILL told me that it has not been confirmed whether the complaint actually originated with the student or if the complaint was made by a faculty member outside the behest of the student. Open record requests are still pending, and due to confidentiality, it may never be known who actually initiated a sexual harassment complaint against three adolescent boys for failing to use they-them pronouns. But it brings up a troubling question that all school districts with gender equity policies and parents should consider. Even in seemingly trivial situations, could a school staff member feel moved or even compelled by their obligations as an educator to rush into the disciplinary process when they observe what they interpret as a violation of the gender identity policy? Like every other person on the planet, school faculty members are human beings and are capable of mistakes. Everybody gets it wrong sometimes, and jumping the gun to take action can certainly qualify as such. But when teachers and administrators get it wrong, it is students, children going through the most awkward years of their lives, who get hurt. Those who favor strict gender identity-based policy seem to contend that the only way to get it right for gender nonconforming students is to implement the policy they've put in place. They're wrong, and it begs a heartbreaking question. How is it that our only solution to support those students is through processes that could in fact further alienate them from their parents, enable risky decision-making, and punish anyone who dares? Unlike the one posed by the group that tried and failed to halt those processes, that's a question that can't be determined by a court of law. Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, he writes, Bird hopes she has her finger on what Iowans want. There's apparently a move afoot to switch the symbol of the Iowa Republican Party from an elephant to a bird, and not the kind with feathers. Republican candidate for Attorney General Brenna Byrd is leading the way with her first television ad. Here's a transcript. Voiceover, Brenna Byrd, the tough-as-nails prosecutor criminals and liberals fear most. Iowan, let's give him the bird. Voiceover, as Attorney General, Brenna Byrd will protect Iowa from Biden's extreme agenda. Iowan, give him the bird. Voiceover, Byrd will defend the rule of law and fight Biden's immigration disaster. Iowan, give him the bird. Iowan, give him the bird. Voiceover, Brenna Byrd will stand with law enforcement and always back the blue. Iowan, give him all the bird. Byrd, I'm Brenna Byrd and I'll give Joe Biden exactly what he deserves. Presumably another bird and a bunch of red state lawsuits. Maybe Byrd hopes the bird can do for her what hog castration did for U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, and that's grab some attention and pump some enthusiasm into her second run against longtime Attorney General Tom Miller, first elected when I was 8 years old. Among a grating, dull array of campaign ads we'll see this fall, it's sure to stand out. Besides, the bird is being recognized more and more in GOP circles. Just last legislative session, State Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican Wilton, displayed a double bird during a rally for a U.S. constitutional convention at the statehouse. It's catching on in the party that's number one in Iowa, according to the index finger. So many, many Iowans have been on the receiving end of GOP birds. It's somewhat ironic that Byrd is running against President Joe Biden, who is not on the ballot. After all, she took exception during her 2010 campaign when Miller asked her in a debate about the several years she spent working as U.S. Representative Steve King's chief of staff. You might remember King, one of America's foremost defenders of white rights. "He is not running for attorney general," Byrd said of King. She also said she would not cover for someone of my own party, although that was years before covering for Donald Trump became a favorite pastime for Iowa Republicans. "I worked for Congressman Steve King. I'm proud of my work serving the 5th Congressional District. Steve King is a hard worker," Byrd said. "I understand you take exception to his conservatism, but one thing about Steve King, agree with him or not, you will always know where he stands on an issue, and that's very important." Byrd worked for King from 2003 until she ran for Attorney General in 2010. And during that time, King made it clear where he stands on several issues. In 2003, he compared LGBTQ Americans to unicorns and leprechauns. "Unicorns, leprechauns, gay marriages in Iowa, these are all things you will never find because they just don't exist," King said. In 2009, after the Iowa Supreme Court struck down Iowa's ban on same-sex marriages, King called for the justices to resign and predicted Iowa would become a gay marriage mecca. LGBTQ Iowans seeking to protect their rights? Give them the bird. In 2005, King sued the Iowa Secretary of State for posting voting information in languages other than English. In 2006, he bought a model of a border wall he designed to the House floor. "We could also electrify this wire with a kind of current that would not kill somebody, but it would be a discouragement for them to be fooling around with it. We do that with livestock all the time," King said. "Newcomers eligible to vote and immigrants seeking a better life? Give them the bird." In 2008, when Barack Obama was running for president, King warned that the future president's middle name, Hussein, would be a big problem. "What does it look like to the world of Islam? And I will tell you that if he is elected president, then the radical Islamists, the Al-Qaeda and the radical Islamists and their supporters will be dancing in the streets in greater numbers than they did on September 11th, King said. People who take exception to King's brand of white supremacist conservatism, give him the bird. After working for King and losing in 2010, Byrd was hired by then-Governor Terry Branstad to be his legal counsel. During that time, Branstad joined a national lawsuit seeking to overturn the Affordable Care Act. Byrd was a key figure in efforts to ban telemedicine abortions in Iowa. Need health care? Value abortion rights? Give them the bird. In 2010, Branstad also tried to hound the state's Workers' Compensation Commissioner, Chris Godfrey, who is gay, out of office to please his business allies. That action resulted in a discrimination lawsuit that cost the state $2.4 million. A jury awarded Godfrey $1.5 million, but the conservative Iowa Supreme Court tossed out the verdict, ruling he couldn't prove Branstad knew Godfrey is gay. "Everybody else around him did know," Godfrey's attorney, Roxanne Conlin, told justices during oral arguments. Brenna Finley Byrd, his counsel, and his chief of staff both admitted they knew Chris Godfrey was gay. "What about Iowans who believe the commissioner should be independent, impartial, and insulated from political influence? Give him the bird." Byrd's new ad buy was paid for with help from a $1 million donation from the Republican Attorneys General Association. The association is led by South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson, who is among 17 GOP attorneys general who joined a lawsuit filed by Texas seeking to nullify the votes of millions of Americans in service to Trump's 2020 election lies. That's the same lawsuit Governor Kim Reynolds regretted not joining, but now she has a chance to have her attorney general in office. During the next presidential election, what will Attorney General Byrd do if the will of the people keeps Trump out of the White House? Give him the bird. In a state that has trended dramatically rightward since 2010, Byrd has a good shot at knocking off Miller, the longest-serving attorney general in American history. If that happens, maybe Byrd will be sworn in with her left hand on the Bible. What she'll be doing with her raised right hand is now anyone's guess. A guest column from writer-editor Jerry Elsie, who retired after 40 years at the Gazette, lasted 15 as opinion age editor. Iowa, get your state gun. Iowa Republican legislators are asking us to troop to the polls November 8th and vote yes on their right to keep and bear arms amendment. 44 other states already have fortified their constitutions that way, they say. Not exactly. Iowa's salute to the Second Amendment adds cryptic language that makes it dangerous. It wards off infringement by liberal judges. Only Louisiana, Alabama, and Missouri have gone that far. So read up on Iowa's amendment before voting. What next? What will be the GOP's follow-up to this nearly undeletable amendment and previously passed laws forsaking the sensible castle doctrine in favor of reckless stand-your-ground and concealed carry? Republicans should do what their counterparts in 9 other states have done. Get a gun. No, not a real firearm. An official state gun. Consider the need. Heed the call to action. Here we are in the heart of the land of the free, birth state of Buffalo Bill and John Wayne, no less, and we lack a firearm to group with a bird, flower, tree, and rock. American goldfinch, wild rose, oak, and geode, respectively. All it would take is a legislative resolution. No probable intrigue or opposition from that perennial stick in the mud, the Democrat Party. Anointing a weapon symbolically as Iowa's own would be safe. It wouldn't hurt anyone. Naming of state guns started just 11 years ago. Utah and Arizona legislatures raced for first place with Utah winning, Browning M1911 pistol, and breathless Arizona, Colt single-action army revolver coming in a month later. Next in order came Indiana, Grouseland rifle, West Virginia, Hall Model 1819 flintlock rifle, Kentucky, Kentucky long rifle, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania long rifle, Alaska, pre-1964 Winchester Model 70, Tennessee, Barrett M82, and Texas, Colt Walker handgun. Those revered weapons are mainly antiques evoking legendary manufacturers or intrepid scouts, Davy Crockett, Daniel Boone. The aura suggests much about the winning of the West without going into the estimated 11 million indigenous people our forebears won it from. Weapons fanciers will spot a thunderous exception in that list. Tennessee's idealized weapon, the Barrett M82, is a 30-pound semi-automatic sniper gun capable of killing an elephant from a mile away, if someone would want to do such a thing. Arnold Schwarzenegger in his heyday couldn't have wielded such a monstrosity, even if aided by Sylvester Stallone, so it must be tripod-mounted. The Barrett M82 is manufactured for Army use by Ronnie Barrett of Tiny, Christiana, Tennessee. By now, you may have spotted a roadblock on the way to naming an official Iowa firearm. The state has a few gun manufacturers, but history shows no iconic weapons producers or beloved gun. The NRA blog offers suggestions for the 41 states deprived so far. Iowa, the NRA recommends the Winchester Model 1892. It was Iowa-born John Wayne's favorite. He used it in several of his Western movies. I'd stick to real life and nominate the muzzle-loading Springfield rifle with mini-ball used by many of the 70,000-plus Iowans who served in the Civil War. 13,000 died. The Union Army's initial use of inferior weaponry was a scandal. Or if lifelong civilian John Wayne must remain in the spotlight, then perhaps the M1 Garand rifle toted by him in several World War II movies and, parenthetically, by tens of thousands of Iowans who fought in that war and Korea. Another Iowa-linked possibility is the Derringer, palm-sized pistol carried by Jock Mahoney, UI swimmer and diver who went on to star in movies and TV series, including Yancey Derringer. But being non-phallic, the Derringer would be a long shot. Best way to solve the problem is running a Name Iowa State Gun contest with a Garand prize for the winner. A symbolic Iowa State gun not only would be non-lethal, there could be good money in it for cash-strapped Republican re-election seekers. As suggested above, the NRA smiles on state guns and those who would enshrine them. Today's editorial cartoon and community letters, the editorial cartoon from Clay Bennett, syndicated cartoonist distributed by Counterpoint Media. We see the back half of a man whose pants are labeled Bannon. He is appearing to tunnel his way out of the brick wall of a prison with a shiv marked pardon on it next to him on the floor. The first letter today is from David Hellman of Salem. Grassley tries to attack Franken's naval career. Chuck Grassley works all right. He's on overtime in his attack on 3-star Admiral Michael Franklin, Grassley's challenger for U.S. Senate. Grassley, who never served in the military, has his well-seasoned cadre of dirt diggers scouring the remarkable 36-year naval career of Franken in hopes of any tiny tidbit that can be twisted to a big-dollar attack ad. Tough job. Franken's military career is impeccable and his leadership experience unmatched by any candidate in the country. Franken even worked during the George W. Bush presidency with Republican Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in the briefing on worldwide orders. So what is the nastiness from Chuck all about? How about diversion? What Grassley should be talking about is his no vote on the Inflation Reduction Act and the lowering of prescription drug and insulin costs for millions of Americans. Franklin dutifully served our nation. If he now seeks to further serve through public office after a distinguished career in uniform, he should have the opportunity. He should be applauded. Nitpicking nastiness as well, curmudgeonly. David Hillman of Salem. The next letter from Dave Ameling of Ossian. Why did Republicans shorten early voting? Counties began mailing out requested mail-in ballots on October 19th. They must be returned to the county by 8 p.m. November 8th. 20 days. I know of letters taking 14 days to go 10 miles, some longer. Republicans cut the days from 40 days to 29 days, and last year to 20 days. Why did they cut the days? They know how slow mail is. That is why they did it. That and not allowing friends to deliver the ballots to the one drop box allowed in each county. They knew limiting the number of mail-in votes means fewer Democratic votes. If Republicans were truly honest about having fair and easier voting, days would go back to 40, friends could deliver the ballots, drop boxes would be across the counties, etc., or we would have online voting. Ask Republicans why. Do not let them shine you on with election security and fraud. Make them give examples of insecurity and fraud. I asked my Republican representatives 2 and 3 years ago that question at town halls. No answers. Our power we prize and our rule we will maintain. They wish. Dave Ameling of Ossian. Next, Matt Brandt of Cedar Rapids writes, Liz Mathis respects our military veterans. So, U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson supports veterans? She also supports Donald Trump, who reportedly referred to American soldiers killed during World War I as suckers and losers. This is just another example of Hinson trying to have things both ways until she is called out on her hypocrisy. Fortunately, the alternative to having Ashley Hinson in Congress is to elect Liz Mathis. State Senator Mathis is in tune with Eastern Iowans and proudly touts that both her parents served in World War II. Please vote and elect Liz Mathis to Congress. Matt Brandt of Cedar Rapids. And the final letter from Carolyn Peterson of Cedar Rapids. Lack of solar panel requirements a risk. Some solar panels are considered hazardous, others are not. The Linn County Board of Supervisors refuses to require utility solar applicants to use non-hazardous panels. The current utility solar project for the Duane Arnold area will use just over 500,000 solar panels, Phase 1 and Phase 2 decommissioning plans, that could be considered hazardous waste when decommissioned or damaged. Some solar batteries emit toxic gases like hydrogen fluoride when they burn, others do not. The Board of Supervisors refuses to require utility solar applicants to use batteries that do not emit toxic gases when they burn. If a battery catches on fire and emits toxic gas, how much gas will be produced and where will it go? So far, the supervisors have refused to hire an expert to evaluate this. Linn County utility solar projects must be placed on land with renewable energy overlay zoning. Renewable energy overlay zoning is only allowed on agricultural and critical natural resource land, not on residential, commercial, or even industrial land. Hazardous panels on critical natural resource land adds environmental risk. These decisions do not appear to me to protect the environment. Three projects, Coggin and Duane Arnold 1 and 2, are already approved. More are coming. If you believe, as I do, that Linn County can do better to set environmentally sound requirements for future projects, please contact our Board of Supervisors at www.linncountyiowa.gov/123/Board of Supervisors. Carolyn Peterson of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 18th, 2022. I am your reader, Sharon Falduto, and we turn to today's obituaries. In the other notices, James O. Fuller, age 85, of Brandon, died Friday, September 16th, Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton. Christopher G. Church, age 58, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, September 12th, Papich Cuba Funeral Home, east of Cedar Rapids. Camilla Jelinek, or Noreen, age 90, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, September 8th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids. James E. Smallridge, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, died Thursday, September 15th, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home of Cedar Rapids. And Marjorie Heinsus Troutman, age 98, of Solon, died Thursday, September 15th, Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center of Solon. John Arden Pilkington, age 86, of Cedar Rapids, died Monday, September 12th, at Heritage Rehabilitation Center from complications of Parkinson's disease and dementia. Private family services will be held. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. John was a man of many interests and talents. He enjoyed showing dogs and breeding Dobermans and toy poodles. John was an excellent cook and baker and delighted in making meals for his family. John was involved with his daughter's Girl Scout troop and was a member of the Doberman Pinschers Club of San Diego. John R. Barta, please join us in celebrating the life of John Robert Barta, 1953 to 2022. The family will be gathering to celebrate his life and would be honored if you would join them. Celebration of Life Open House, Saturday, October 15th, 2 to 4 p.m., National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library, 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Patricia Ann Wilderman, we hope that you can join us in celebrating the full life of Patricia Ann Wilderman and sharing stories and happy memories with us. The Celebration of Life service will be held 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Sunday, September 25th, at 7427 28th Avenue, Watkins. Robert Zager, age 75, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, September 13th, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, September 21st, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, September 22nd, at the funeral home. Robert loved to travel. He loved the Iowa Hawkeyes and spending time with friends and family. Elizabeth Ann Wagner, known as Betty, age 93, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Tuesday, September 13th. Per Betty's request, no services will be held. She spent 34 years proudly serving the community as a registered nurse at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Opal M. Miller of Cedar Rapids passed away at Mercy Hospital on September 12th, surrounded by family. Per her request, there will not be a service. Vincent Mills, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on August 2nd at Cottage Grove Health Center in Cedar Rapids. Vincent was a longtime resident of the Cedar Rapids area, having emigrated from Britain in 1965. A celebration of life will be held at 4:30 p.m. September 25th at Indian Creek Nature Center, 5300 Otis Road, Southeast. Ronald Herrick of Cedar Rapids, Ron, peacefully passed away April 3, 2022. Please come join us in celebrating Ron's life from noon to 5 p.m. September 24th at Lake McBride Main Lodge, Lake McBride Northeast in Solon. Lunch will be provided. Craig Irvin Borchardt, age 73, died at his home in Marengo, Iowa on August 31, 2022 of natural causes. Craig was grateful to have worked as a welder for Kinsey Manufacturing for many years. He spoke of how Kinsey went above and beyond in supporting him following a motorcycle accident. Craig was a gifted storyteller with an ability to recall details that brought his stories to life. His love of all things motorcycle began at age 4 when a neighbor rode past the farmhouse where he grew up. That love for motorcycles lasted his whole life. He was an avid reader and loved to listen to music, especially Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Merle Haggard. Memorial services will be at a future date. Scott J. DeVore of Cedar Rapids died unexpectedly September 13, 2022. He was born January 13, 1955 in Cedar Rapids. He and his dad, Richard, were the last father-son team to work at Universal Engineering, where he worked for 29 years, serving both the company and its staff as a union steward. He was a man of the people and for the people. A beloved member of the community, you could find him on any bike trail in any season. For more stories, tears, and celebrations, join us at Parlor City Pub and Eatery from 2 to 6 p.m. Friday, September 23rd. Ride your bike and come in your favorite bike jersey, where we'll plan to do a short trail ride to send him off at 6 p.m. Frances Geneva Nussbaum, known as Fran of Iowa City, age 94, passed away September 5th, 2022. Visitation will be from 4 to 5 p.m. Friday, September 23rd at Lensing Funeral Home in Iowa City. A memorial service will follow at 5 p.m. Graveside services will be at 11:30 a.m. Saturday, September 24th at New Bern Cemetery near Cheriton. Richard Luce, known as Dick, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Coggin, died Friday, September 9th at Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. Celebration of life, 2 to 5 p.m. Friday, September 30th at Pizza Ranch in Marion. Burial, Coggin Cemetery. TN Funeral Home and Cremation is serving the family. Dick owned Dick's Plumbing and Heating and Youthland in Coggin. He was a volunteer firefighter for the Coggin Fire Department for over 20 years and was on the Coggin Light Plant Board. Dick was an American Red Cross disaster volunteer and donated blood for many years. He's also an avid Chicago Cubs fan. William Dwayne Bartosh, age 86, of Belle Plaine, went to see the Lord on Tuesday, September 13th at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A celebration of life will be from 2 to 5 p.m. Friday, October 1st at the Community Center in Belle Plaine. William enjoyed fishing and playing cards. Bill's smile and joking manner will be greatly missed by all who knew him. Robert Zirkelbach, age 93, of Monticello, died Tuesday, August 2nd at the Jones Regional Medical Center following a brief illness. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, September 24th at Little Country Church in Scotch Grove, 2 miles east of Scotch Grove on E-17. with private family interment in the Oakwood Cemetery. Friends may call after 9 a.m. Saturday at the church. Getch Funeral Home in Monticello has taken Bob and his family into their care. Bob started farming on the family farm near Scotch Grove for over 40 years. He worked at Swiss Valley Co-op part-time after he retired. Bob was a lifelong member of the Scotch Grove Presbyterian Church, where he served as an elder. He was a member of Farm Bureau, a 4-H leader, and a member of the Jones County Extension Board. He loved to go golfing at the Scotch Grove Coon Hunters Club, and he volunteered at Camp Wyoming and the Jones County Historical Society at Edinburgh Village. Betty Ina Lynn died on Labor Day, September 5, 2022, a fitting date for a woman who worked so hard her entire life. She was born over 100 years ago, on March 8, 1922. A celebration of life service will be held on Saturday, September 24th, at the Rochester Methodist Church at 11 a.m. At 1 p.m., Betty will be buried in the P.D. Cemetery. Robert G. Adams, known as Bob, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, died Wednesday, September 14th, at Mercy Medical Center. Celebration of Life Gathering will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, September 19th, at the Brosh Chapel in the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Private family interment will be at a later date. Bob served in the U.S. Marine Corps during the Vietnam War. He was a mechanic for many years, including at Rapids Chevrolet. Bob thoroughly enjoyed living life to the fullest. He enjoyed hunting, riding his Harleys, enjoying a drink, shooting his guns, and spending time with his family. Donald Fred Richard Andreessen, age 84, of Spirit Lake, formerly of Keystone, was called to heaven on Wednesday, September 7th, from Keelson's Harbor Assisted Living, where he and his wife Norma reside. Memorial services will be held at 2:30 p.m. Saturday, October 1st, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel in Keystone, with Reverend David Simonson officiating. Visitation will be held at the funeral home from 1 p.m. until the start of the 2:30 p.m. memorial service. Interment will be held at the Keystone Cemetery at a later date. A memorial fund has been established to go to Lakes Regional Healthcare Home Care and Hospice. Don and Norma farmed the family farm west of Keystone for 21 years, from 1956 to 1977. He drove a school bus for Benton Community School District for 14 years. Then in Spencer, he worked for Morton Buildings and the City of Spencer Street Department and City Hall. He truly enjoyed operating a payloader and snowplow trucks, as well as working with the public. He enjoyed gardening, camping, walking, and birdwatching, and he was a member of the Optimist Club and volunteered in Meals on Wheels at Cherish Center and is a Dickinson County Trail Security writer. John DeClotz, age 79, of Shellsburg, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday, September 14th, following a sudden illness. Memorial services will be held at 1:30 p.m. Thursday, September 22nd, at the Phillips Funeral Home Chapel, 212 East 6th Street in Vinton, the Reverend Douglas Voltemath officiating. Visitation will be held at the funeral home from 4 to 8 p.m. Wednesday. John was a dedicated John Deere farmer in the Shellsburg area and also operated DeClotz Trucking, retiring in 2018. He truly loved to farm. John had an adventurous spirit and an outgoing personality. He drove dirt track stock cars in his younger years. He was musically inclined and was a huge fan of Lawrence Welk. He was active in his community as a member of the Shellsburg Lions Club and served on the Shellsburg School Board. Lloyd Marvin Hughes of Lisbon, a funeral mass for Lloyd, age 86, who passed away on September 7th, will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, September 26th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Mechanicsville, with burial and military honors to follow in Rose Hill Cemetery. Thomas George McCuskey, age 74, of Keokuk, died Thursday, September 8th, at Blessing Health Hospital in Keokuk. Tom attended law school at Drake University, received his J.D. in 1974, and went on to practice law in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. He also taught in the paralegal program at Kirkwood Community College, where he loved helping students further their ambitions. He attended 6 Olympic Games throughout his life and was an avid reader of current events, politics, history, and liked nothing more than sitting on his deck overlooking the Mississippi River. A memorial gathering will be held at a later date. David L. Levon, age 84, of Marion and longtime resident of Mount Vernon, passed away Tuesday, September 13th, at the Strawberry Point Lutheran Home. Funeral services, 10:30 a.m. Friday, September 23rd, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Mount Vernon, Pastor Ken Ferguson officiating. Visitation, 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, September 22nd, at the funeral home. Burial will be in the Lisbon Cemetery. Graveside military honors will be rendered by the U.S. Air Force National Guard, National Honor Guard. Stuart Baxter Funeral Home and Memorial Service of Mount Vernon is assisting the family. Turning to sports, and in case you're wondering, the Hawkeyes did eventually win at about 1:30 in the morning after a couple of lightning delays with the Nevada game yesterday. From the sports page, Iowa State 43, Ohio 10, imperfect but still a W, by Rob Gray, correspondent at Ames. Iowa State first-year starting quarterback Hunter Deckers shined as usual in a passing game. His top target, Xavier Hutchinson, posted big numbers yet again, and the Cyclones cruised to a 43-10 win Saturday over outmanned Ohio at Jack Trice Stadium while simultaneously proving why their head coach, Matt Campbell, often refers to football as a game of imperfection. Boy, was it ever. ISU coughed up a red zone fumble and saw an extra point blocked, and that was just before trotting into halftime with a 30-3 lead. But the Cyclones, 3-0, also forced four turnovers. Deckers completed 28 of 36 passes for 268 yards and three touchdowns, and Hutchinson caught one of them while amassing at least 93 receiving yards for the sixth time in the past seven regular season games. I was probably irate at halftime just because you're up 30-3 and your eyes see all the things that are going to cost us when we need it the most, Campbell said. And if we don't clean those things up, then we could be happy being 3-0. I'm not. I still feel like there's so much proof of who we can be and what we need to become if we're willing to get there. Deckers was sacked twice in a row on one second-half drive, but otherwise was well-protected, while boosting his career touchdown-to-interception ratio to 11-4. His three touchdown passes went to Hutchinson, Sean Shaw Jr., and Deshaun Hanika, so he continued to connect with a diverse range of targets. There are some high-end highs, and there are some lows that we've got to get figured out, Campbell said. The ball security piece of it is something we've got to continue to strain to work on, and yet there's some critical plays that he makes in the football game that we're not the team we've got the ability to be if he doesn't make those plays. Senior linebacker Orion Vance's strip sack in the second quarter produced a fumble the defensive end M.J. Anderson recovered. Senior safety Anthony Johnson rose up for a sprawling first-half interception, the first of his career, and graduate transfer linebacker Colby Reeder picked off his second pass in as many weeks, returning it to the Bobcats' 9-yard line. Defensive lineman Joey Peterson forced a fourth-quarter fumble that Hunter Zenzen recovered at the Ohio 12-yard line. Jace Gilbert subsequently capped ISU's scoring with a 21-yard field goal with 8:14 left, sending swaths of what remained of the announced crowd of 58,138 shuffling toward the exits. Add Will McDonald's program record-extending 30th sack, and a recipe for ongoing success emerges, even if some of the ingredients somewhat sour the mix. I'm just blessed to have the ability to do all of that, said McDonald, who notched his first sack of the season. So a lot of good coexisted with a sprinkling of bad for ISU, which is 3-0 to start the season for the first time since 2012 and begins Big 12 play next Saturday against defending conference champion Baylor 2-1 at home. It's every week like this, Shaw said. Just because it's Big 12 play, we're not looking at it any different. We're treating every week the same, and it's going to stay that way. And finally, the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Gazzy, three-legged black bear, was the star attraction at Cedar Rapids Beaver Park Zoo in the 1940s, by Diane Fannin Langton, correspondent. Gazzy, a black bear, was born at Beaver Park's modest zoo in Cedar Rapids in 1941. He wasn't the first bear to live at the zoo. That honor belonged to Gussie, also a black bear, who arrived at the zoo in 1901, shortly after the zoo opened. A large cage was created for Gussie, who was labeled a fun maker because she liked to jump at dogs when they walked past and frighten them. The zoo began around 1900 with the donation of a pair of American Eagles from railroad ticket clerk Archie Steese and some deer from J.J. Bud Snauffer Jr. By 1904, Cedar Rapids had established a Beaver Park streetcar line to carry visitors to the park. The advertised attractions included a deer park, a big swing, a well house, bandstand, two bridges, and elk, deer, bears, wolves, foxes, monkeys, birds, and other zoological specimens. Bill Voltz was the park's zookeeper in April 1941 when a Gazette photographer snapped a photo of a mother bear and her new cub. Thousands of people flocked to the zoo to catch a glimpse of the cub, who was dubbed Gazzy in honor of the newspaper. The mother bear entertained the crowds gathered on the hillside walk above the bear pit by picking up her cub and rolling backward, giving the cub a ride through the air. Gazzy's adventurous life took a dismaying turn when he was 4.5 months old. He wandered too close to the tin partition that separated his cage from that of his father. The older bear caught Gazzy's rear left leg and mauled it so badly that it had to be amputated above the knee. Gazzy slept well after his operation and recovered quickly. He soon became the most popular animal the city zoo has ever had. By the time he was 7 months old, Gazzy was learning to be an excellent escape artist. Placed in a temporary enclosure at the zoo while his cage was being repaired, Gazzy broke his collar and climbed a large tree out of reach of caretakers. Volz's attempts to coax him down only resulted in the cub climbing higher. The fire department came and extended a ladder above the bear, driving him down into the arms of three men who combined efforts to put a new harness on Gazzy. The next day, Gazzy was free again when a clasp on the harness came loose. Gazzy headed for a tree's upper branches. This time, a zoo attendant, armed with a club, climbed high enough to poke Gazzy until he decided to come down. The next year, the zoo's cub trouble tripled when Gazzy was joined by twin siblings. Even so, Gazzy was still the star attraction. In October 1942, Parks Commissioner Charles Kosek announced that the Beaver Park Zoo's attractions would be drastically reduced because of World War II. On top of Volz enlisting in the Army, meat rationing was going to severely restrict the zoo's ability to feed the carnivores. Four bears, four foxes, a wolf, and a coyote would have to go, but the zoo would keep the twin bear cubs. The backlash was immediate. Zoo lovers thought the animals were going to be killed. Offers to take them poured in from San Antonio, Milwaukee, and other places. Kosek finally announced no animals were going to be killed. He said the bison were going to an 800-acre farm in Otley in central Iowa because their zoo enclosure was too small. Two of four elk would be relocated along with nearly 30 goats, five foxes, and one wolf. Two old bears were leaving, but Gazzy, the cubs, and a Canadian bear were staying. The last mention of Gazzy in the Gazette was a February 1948 story about the birth of a bear cub that was Gazzy's half-sibling. In April 1982, Moose and Molly, the last of the black bears at the Beaver Park Zoo, were loaded onto trucks to be hauled to new homes when they became too expensive to keep. The zoo's lions and wolves also were moved to new homes. The aging zoo was becoming financially unsustainable, and by 1999, most of the zoo's animal enclosures had been replaced with picnic areas. The last vestige of exotic animals was the monkey exhibit, which closed in 2003. Today, Beaver Park is home to Old McDonald's Farm, a petting farm that includes a waterfowl exhibit. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, September 18th, 2022. I have selected and lightly edited the articles from today's Gazette. My name is Sharon Falduto. I've been reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recording at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org, and we do welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.